Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock, and welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, January 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Time to talk car maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. You have a car question? Call us. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Full disclosure, President Biden is supposed to speak. He was supposed to start at 1:30. Not ready yet. So at some point, we'll probably break from the show and hear from the prez. But in the meantime, call with your question. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke's here. We'll be back. Oh, am I on? I'm on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. We just heard President Biden on a big day in international politics and good news all around. Now we'll talk cars with Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive Incorporated in Hoosick Falls, New York. He's been in the automotive repair industry for more than 30 years. He is a great guest on this program. We moved him a day. He's usually on Tuesdays. We moved him to Wednesday because Governor Hochul was doing her State of the State. Well, that's the way things roll sometimes. Gordon, are you there?
I'm here, Ray. Yeah, you bumped me by the governor and now the president. What's up?
Well, I don't know, but maybe the Pope will be next month. I'm not sure.
We'll okay that.
All right, man. If there's white smoke, you don't do a show. How you doing?
Right.
What's going on?
Good. Well, you know, we're hammering right along. Pretty good. How about you?
You know, it's cold. I don't like it. I took the day off yesterday since I didn't have a show and gave the caddy a good workout on the thruway, and it worked out. It's driving great.
That's phenomenal.
It's fun to drive. So I saw a commercial. Before I get to the emails here, and by the way, feel free to call 800-323. That's the fun drive number, Ray. 800-348-2551 is the number for this program. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Before I get to the questions today, I watched a commercial on TV the other day. I think it was during football, and it scared the daylights out of me. There are these trucks, and all the wheels steer, and it looks, I don't know whether they call it crab walking or whatever, but it looks scary and dangerous, and what's the deal, Gordon Fricke?
Yeah, so it is crab walking. I think that's that might be the Hummer EV that you saw.
I don't know, man, but I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that.
So actually, that concept is quite old.
Yeah.
General Motors actually had a four-wheel steering on their pickup trucks in the 2000s, and they called it Quadra Steer.
Oh.
And I remember the trucks. I remember servicing them. I remember the mechanism. It was their four-wheel drive pickups, half ton, and the rear axle looked like the front axle. Ball joints, steering linkage, a little steering mechanism back there. They didn't steer as sharply as that truck you saw crab walking.
Yeah.
And they were made to kind of let the truck go through turns with greater ease, like you had a much shorter wheelbase.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they had a crab walk feature. I don't think they did. And then some of your Japanese cars dabbled with it in their performance cars, and they had four-wheel steer, which limited the rear wheels to a very, very minor angle, maybe 3 degrees.
Yeah.
Acura had some four-wheel steer. Mitsubishi had some. They all dropped it. GM corrosion and rust problems in the Northeast totally destroyed it, and most of them, they just reverted them back to normal front wheel steer.
All right,
but anyway,
so aside
the idea's been out there.
Okay, aside from shortening the wheelbase or the turning radius or whatever, are there any advantages as a driver to having something like that?
I do believe the handling is improved on sports cars is what they were experimenting with a lot. And they would get through corners much nicer.
Huh.
And with big, long vehicles, in and out of parking spaces and maneuvering is a dream, as you could see on that commercial. But all the complexity, all the extra parts, all the extra costs, really, is it worth it? I don't know.
Well, it's probably worth it to someone who's in the automotive repair industry. Cha-ching, yeah?
Well, it depends. You know, some repairs are ugly, and you don't even want to do them, you know? So I don't know.
All right. Well, let's tell you what. Let's take a break and handle some underwriting, and then we'll come back. We'll hit the emails and the phones. Gordon Fricke is our guest today. 800-348-2551 or VoxPop at WAMC.org. Cause today. We'll talk about cause coming up. Count Basie, the song is Quince, which was written by Quincy Jones. He wrote a song with his own name, isn't it? It's very good, though. The number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke joins us every month, if we can squeeze him in with all the political talk, to talk cars with you. This email came in much earlier today from Michael in Benson. And Michael writes, why don't you see more commercial dealings of kit cars and road-legal buggies? It's an arm and a leg to find old dirty chassis to start a buggy kit without getting one special ordered new. There are no commercial outlets that I have seen that offer kits or hardware offline. There seem to be no dealer that pre-builds any kits for the less ambitious but still curious consumer, with the exception of a handful across the whole country. People build classics and hot rods. Why are buggies and kit cars so unpopular, or is this hard work the allure of the kit culture? And that's from Michael in Benson.
Yeah, it's interesting because kit cars were pretty popular in the probably 60s, 70s, 80s, and there were a lot of them out there. And a ton of them were made on Volkswagen Beetle chassis because it was so easy to unbolt the body and put a kit car on it, and you got all the running gear you need pre-done, you know, ready to go. But I don't know if it's – I'm sure it's the marketing and the desire. Maybe there's so few people that would be willing to do it or want to do it that there's no money in it. There were high-end kits, Cobra. There was some companies, and I'm sure they still do, making Cobra replicas. And there were some really good ones, and there was some others that were duplicating long-nosed cars out of the 30s and stuff. But
yeah, I remember those.
I have a feeling it just evolved out, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of long-nosed cars out of the 30s, one of those that came along, I want to say in the 90s, was the Plymouth Prowler. I always thought that was the coolest-looking car. Whatever happened to those?
Very, very, very poor sales.
Yeah.
Just never took off. And it didn't have a V8 engine.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, thought, okay, if you're going to have a car that looks like that, it should have a V8 for the look, the sound, the rumble and all that.
Right.
And they put a V6 in it, you know.
Did you ever work on one?
No. I saw there was a few around, and I, you know, got up close to them, but never experienced them.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Gordon Fricke's our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. Before I start, don't forget Lockbox is open at WAMC.org. It's open all the time. We're looking for your pledges now. Every dollar we raise will count on minute one of our fund drive, which begins February 3rd. So if you want to make a pledge now, you're doing your bit to get us back to regular programming that much quicker. It's WAMC.org. Now let's go to Jim in Stone Ridge. Jim, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I've got a 2001 Ford Escape, which I purchased in 2012 with about 20,000 miles, and it got 20 miles per gallon. Now it's got 145,000 miles, and it gets 17.5 miles per gallon. So I wonder if you got any thoughts about the loss of decline in mileage. My own mechanic says, and try to figure out what's causing it, why I spend far more than I'd ever recover in future gas efficiency. But I'm interested in Gordon's view.
Okay, Gordon.
Yeah, we get that call quite often, and we get it when gas prices spike. But there's a handful of ways to make sure you're getting the best fuel economy out of any vehicle, and it's a combination of a bunch of things, because even the age of that Escape, the engine management is under the control of a computer, an ECM or a PCM. So you can't do really much tweaking outside of that. It's watching the fuel mixture, and it's trying to optimize it at all times. But the basic things still have to happen. Good clean air filter, good state of tune, spark plugs, tire pressure, tire brand, and rolling resistance makes a difference. If you put some big AT tires on it, your gas mileage is definitely going to go down. Alignment has a major effect on gas mileage, because if the alignment is out of whack, the tires are creating a lot of drag, and over a period of time, they'll soak up some economy. Speaking of the state of tune, deposits, they get on your intake valves, they get on your piston tops, and they will rob power. And there are good additives that you can put in the gas to drive those deposits clean. Those are the key things. And the older the engine gets, the more wear it develops, the less efficient it is. The piston rings aren't as good as they once were, sealing the combustion chambers. The engine just gets a little sloppy, and there's not much you're going to be able to do about that. So those are the key items.
Jim, you want to follow up very quickly here?
Yeah, that's a very useful list. I just want to mention that, happily, I replaced the spark plugs maybe around 100,000 miles, 80,000 miles. I got them all done by 100,000. But it cost about $1,000 to replace them all because they're so hard. They're hidden under the intake manifold.
Oh, man. Spark
plugs? But the rest of it sounds pretty good.
All right, thanks, Jim. Spark plugs would cost a grand to do, Gordon? What has gone wrong with the world?
Well, you know, some vehicles, and not so much that Escape, but Ford had an engine for a while called a Triton, and it was a V8, 5.4 liter. And if Don is listening, he might correct me on that. But I have a Ford Master Tech with me, so that's why I mentioned Don's name in the shop.
Uh-huh.
But those Triton engines had a horrendous spark plug arrangement. Ford developed a new spark plug that was 10 times deeper and longer. It had, you know, 1,000 threads that were into the cylinder head. The tip of the spark plug went into the combustion chamber. Make a long story short, they would break inside the head very commonly when you went to remove them. So you could run into a complete disaster on changing spark plugs in those engines. Those could easily hit $1,000 or more if you got to pull a head off.
Yikes,
the Escape, not so bad, but maybe they ran into similar problems because they stayed in too long. But
how many threads are on a usual spark plug?
Well, the tip of the spark plug usually goes in probably 3/4 of an inch. The Tritons are way, way deeper. The tip of that spark plug is like 3 times that long. It just goes into Never Never Land. And
why did they do that? Why?
Design of the head. They wanted to make a long life spark plug, better combustion. And Ford was one of the first ones to say, hey, we got plugs that'll last 100,000 miles. That's great until you can't remove them. You might have been better off changing them every 30, 40, or 50, and then they would come out.
Yikes.
But that whole thing is gone. And most of those Tritons are, you know, they've had it.
This email came in from Linda, looking to buy a used car. I'm looking to buy a used car, and after speaking to my mechanic, he suggests Honda, Toyota, or Subaru. I had a Pontiac Vibe, which I loved dearly, but the transmission conked out, and I don't know if it's a good idea to get another one because it's not good in snowy conditions, so I'm looking for all-wheel drive. Here's the tricky part, Gordon. Linda writes, my budget is $3,200. What is a good, reliable hatchback car that you would suggest? Also, what's the maximum mileage I should look for? And that's from Linda.
Oh, boy, there's no good answers to that, really, because as we all know, the cost of vehicles over the last 5-6 years in particular has really skyrocketed, both new and used. unfortunately, that's a slim budget.
Yeah.
So you're going to be looking at something older with higher mileage on it, and she's going to want to stick with the legacy brands that are known for durability and fewer breakdowns. And she hit the nail on the head. Honda, Toyota, and a very, very overlooked brand is Mazda. They build very good vehicles. They're Japanese. They're a smaller company. You don't see all the hoopla like you do with Toyota and Honda, who are into racing, and Honda's into power sports. It's a much more recognizable name. But you got to try to get the newest car you can with the lowest miles for the best money, and that's not easy to do.
For $3,200, it is.
And that's a tough budget.
You know, Mazda's great, though. I mean, Don, your Ford tech, should know the great synergy they had with Ford, and at least in the early 90s, they made some great engines for some Ford products. I know because I had one. Let's go to Del Mar, and we'll talk to Francis. Francis, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've got a 2016 VW Golf Sport Wagon. I just recently purchased it. It's got a light coming on the dashboard that says EPC. It doesn't come on every time I start it up, but like
EPC.
Maybe every other time.
What is EPC, Gordon?
So she's kind of fading.
Uh-oh, you're fading. Is Gordon gone?
I'm here. Are you there, Ray?
Yeah, are you there, Francis?
Yep.
All right, everybody's here.
Everybody's back.
All right, go ahead, man.
So EPC is electronic power control.
Okay.
And it's a leg of the ECM, which ties into the check engine light and all the things that have to do with vehicle running. And a lot of weird things can turn that light on a Volkswagen, some not even related to the powertrain. What should happen is she should get the vehicle scanned and see if it's tied into a code for the powertrain control module, and then see where that leads you. It could be a throttle body or a throttle control issue. That's a common one for EPC. But there can be sensors and other features in there that will cause that light to come on. So initially it doesn't give you trouble. It just starts to give you early warning. It thinks something's up.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, if Francis were to get one of the inexpensive scanning devices at a store, would that be able to deep dive enough to show the proper code?
Well, if it is the check engine light ever on or just EPC?
Just the EPC.
Yeah. So usually when the EPC light is on, it will lead to a trouble code. But a lot of those codes will not turn the check engine light on. They're not strong enough for the EPA to think they're going to affect emissions. So to answer your question, Ray, the intro scan tool that you might get at an auto parts store might go in and get a code, or it might not. But it's not worth the money to get something that goes deep to go into your European end of the software for a homeowner or a vehicle owner to have. But I think it'd be worth a scan, just in case there's something coming up that needs to be addressed before it creates trouble.
Francis.
Right. Okay.
All right. Well,
great.
Thanks for the call.
Yep. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Yep.
You got it.
800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest today. It's automotive maintenance and repair on Vox Pop. And let's go to Saratoga. Sally, you're on.
Hi, thank you very much.
You bet.
I have a Mitsubishi, 2005 Mitsubishi Eclipse, and all of a sudden the service engine soon light comes on, then it goes out, then it comes on a day later. Meanwhile, all of a sudden my engine will quit right while I'm in the middle of driving. It stops, and then I have to turn the key and start it again, and I'll drive 5 minutes, and then it'll happen again, but not all the time, but almost all the time lately. I don't know what's going on. I've changed the starter motor and the battery.
Yeah, I think the check engine light is not going to report your battery or your starter's condition, but it's going to report or check on things that control how the engine runs and operates. And the fact that the light is on and you're having drivability concerns, you really should get that thing checked out soon, because I think it's on the edge of probably something's going to fail, and maybe you won't get another restart out of it. And there could be 100 different codes once it gets scanned to sort out, and then it won't bring up 100 codes, but there's so many codes that could come up. You've got to get it tested and diagnosed. Could be a lot of things. Could be a mass airflow sensor, right? That hits a nerve with Ray. But it could be a lot of other things.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that hit nerves with me, Sally. You want to follow up real fast here?
Just that, like I said, I recently changed all that stuff on it. So the fact that it keeps happening. Oh, I only have 135,000 miles on it. That was the other thing. It's not, you know, that's not that much for a Mitsubishi, right?
So changing those components earlier, were you attempting, or was somebody attempting to solve this problem, or did you have other problems with starting?
No, it was just to solve that problem, which was happening before.
Did anybody ever plug it in and scan it and read codes?
Well, that's what they, yeah, they did that, and that's when they said I should, change the first it was the starter, then the starter motor. And then it went away. So I thought everything was copacetic until it started happening again.
Yeah, I think there's something deeper in there than the starting system. So I think it's got to get retested.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sally, thanks for the call. All right. Betsy wrote in. And actually, I think Betsy was very excited because it came six times in a row. But Betsy's question is this. What's the deal with the new plugs? They seem to last so much longer. How are they made? I used to change my own and gap them, still have a spark plug gauge. I miss being able to do a lot of my own maintenance. Remember points and condensers? I used to set them with my Swiss Army knife. Betsy, who rebuilt a 1963 VW with the complete idiot's manual, which she still has. All right, what do you think?
Well, that's a very good question, and what she's saying is totally the trend in today's world. So back in the 60s VW trend, or with the Idiot's Guide to VW's book, those engines, all engines, not just Volkswagens, they were pretty inefficient and sloppy. And the ignition systems were very weak. They didn't produce a tremendous amount of current for the spark plugs. You were carbureted. You didn't have good electronic control. So those things needed spark plugs probably every year in those days. The engines are so sharp now, they're so well-tuned by virtue of the onboard computer, they run so efficiently and lean that the spark plugs last a tremendous amount of time.
Interesting.
What happens now is the electrodes just wear out from all the current passing by them, and the gaps get so big that they eventually take too much power to fire, and then you start having misfires, and it weakens the coils and all that. But that's why they last so much longer, because they're in such a cleaner, more efficient environment, and the technology has improved of the spark plugs themselves.
You know, the old Ford I had in the early 90s, I didn't know anything. I was in my 20s. I didn't know anything about cars. I'm driving along, and all of a sudden in the early 90s, it's raining, and my car stalls at lights. And I said, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this? What turned out, I had never changed the plugs. It was about 80,000 miles in, and once I changed the plugs, that problem went away. So there you go.
Yeah, maybe it was long enough ago where it also had wires. Ignition wires were a common issue in super wet weather.
No, interesting. All right, this is from Karen. Remember Francis, who had that interesting issue that we were talking about scanning it? And
right.
Karen brings up a good point. Most automotive parts stores will do a scan on the ECM.
Oh, yes. Yeah, just about all of them will. And I just had a car in the other day with a check engine light on, and there was a paper from one of the auto parts stores in there where they did a complimentary scan, and they had a code for a misfiring cylinder number 4. And a little note came up, said, the ignition coil is a likely cause of your misfire. We highly recommend that you replace it. And then there was a little fine print that says we can't guarantee any of the stuff we're telling you here. But yeah, you can get scanned in an auto parts store and get codes for sure.
Okay, let's go. We'll grab one more call before the next break. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number to Gloversville and Noah. Noah, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I've got a 2005 Dodge Dakota whose heat is kind of funky. In a way, it'll make a lot of noise when it just, it'll just blow nothing, or it'll blow very weak. This is in, like, very cold weather, and it hasn't been happening as much, but I'm just wondering what that possibly could be.
So the blower motor sounds really noisy. Is that what you're saying?
It'll blow, but no heat will come out.
Okay, so you're getting airflow, but not warm air.
Heater core?
Is that correct?
No hot air come out the vent.
Okay, but good airflow. Good lot of wind coming out of the vents, but it's not hot air.
I can hear it, and I'll hold my hand over the vent, and it'll feel like nothing is coming out. Maybe I have bad airflow as well.
Okay,
I don't know.
So,
and only
what year is the vehicle?
2005.
Okay, it may be too old, but we run into a lot of plugged and super, super dirty cabin air filters. And they're located.
But mine doesn't have it.
I think yours is too old. The other thing you can check for is obstructions or debris in your cowl area where the air comes in. It's usually on that truck under the windshield wipers or somewhere in that area. You just want to make sure the fan has the ability to pull a lot of air in from the outside, but you also could have a flap problem in your ductwork, in your heater housing that directs the air. And there's flaps, and probably that truck's probably old enough where there may be even cables or vacuum-operated flap controls. And it may be that the air is not getting directed past the heater core the way it's supposed to, and unfortunately, that is not a fun and easy job on some vehicles because you've got to get under the dash, take a bunch of stuff apart, and see what's going on. If it's a vacuum-controlled heater, you could have a vacuum problem, and it's not getting any signals to do anything. And they usually resort to windshield only when the vacuum fails. But I got a feeling you got a problem in either getting air past the blower motor, and or the blower motor's got a problem itself, or there's leaves in it or something, and or control problems. None of it's, you know, very fun.
No, that's too bad. Noah, thanks for the call. We have to take a break here. We are overdue. Gordon Fricke is our guest from Barber and Fricke in Hoosick Falls, New York. 800-348-2551. We will be right back. Buddy Rich Big Band, Roar of 74 is the album. Very young Tony Levin on bass on that track. Senator Sam here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. All right, Gordon Fricke, an email here from Rob. And I read it, and I'll tell you, and you know this already, that I freak out about the same thing sometimes. Rob writes, I understand this is vague, but could your esteemed guest possibly talk about oil pressure? Maybe just a PSA with some basic info, safe operating numbers for 4-cycle, 6, 8, changing manufacturer's recommendations for oil weight, using additives, Example, my Chevy Silverado runs at 40 for 1,000 miles after an oil change, runs at 25 when I'm due for an oil change. Right now, my Silverado has about 220,000 miles, and that's from Rob, who says, go Bills, and I agree.
Wow, a lot of questions there, but they seem to be oil-related and maybe some pressure.
Oil
questions.
Pressure, that's it, oil pressure, that's
right. Yeah, yeah. So oil pressure varies depending on the manufacturer for various reasons. They're using oil for a lot of different reasons now in engines. It used to just get pumped around to lubricate the bearings and all the moving parts. Now it's being directed and being used as a hydraulic fluid to move cam phasers and variable valve timing components. So the oil's doing a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
It's now deactivating cylinders for better fuel economy on V8 engines. But sometimes knowing the pressure with a gauge on the dash is a bad thing.
That's what you told me. Exactly what you told me.
And I get that from a classic individual that I worked for decades and decades ago. His name was John Cahill, and he said you should not have an oil pressure gauge in a car. You just have a light that works, and if the light comes on, you got to stop it the second the light comes on, and that's the end of the story. People will stare at the light. Oh, my God, today it's 42. Yesterday was 38. Now it's 51. It varies. The oil is thicker when it's cold.
The pump
may not be able to relieve the pressure when it's that thick, so the oil pressure is a lot higher till it warms up. So, you know, it moves around a lot. And then if you get a funky reading from the sending unit on the engine or the gauge is inaccurate, the gauge is all over the place. But make a long story short, at hot idle, the pump's turning pretty slow. You know, most engines, the light or the bare minimum is not very high, 7, 8 PSI, something like that. Sounds low, but, you know, it's enough. The engine's not doing anything but idling.
Right.
You get it up to highway speed. Let's say your RPMs are, let's say, you know, 1,500, 2 grand. Most engines probably like to be in the 40 to 50 PSI range, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And so what else was the... Did you talk about oil interval changes too? Was that part
I think it was really about the pressure, and he was giving some examples. And, you know, when my car, like, I don't like to warm the car up more than a couple minutes. I just figured, okay, the oil is going to get through the entire vehicle in 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'm off. But if I hit the gas too hard at a stop sign or whatever, it'll my meter will go up to 80, 90 PSI for a split second. And then once it warms up, it's fine.
Yeah, well, it shoots up till it hits the relief valve, and then it settles back down, basically.
All right, we'll shift gears here, and then we'll go to the phones. This is from Pamela. Few times recently, although I always leave the radio on in my 2012 Ford Econoline when I park, when I start the van, the radio doesn't come on. If I turn the van off, get out, close everything up, then start over, the radio comes back on. This has happened a few times in recent years, usually in cold weather. WTH is going on, and that's from Pamela in Troy, New York.
Well, a lot of vehicles have a feature where if you shut the key off, shut the engine off, everything in the car stays live for a while. The radio, you know, you can operate different things until you open the driver's door, and then bang, it shuts everything off.
Yep.
And that's getting a signal from the door switch telling the computer, the body control module, they're getting out of the car now. Power this thing down. It was a luxury or an option to leave the radio and different things on until that time. I'm wondering if it's related to the switch on the door.
Interesting.
Because Ford had a lot of problems with micro switches in those door latches, and a little bit of penetrating oil in all of those latches and exercising the door open and shut 10, 15, 20 times can solve a ton of problems in those micro switch door latches.
All right.
That's just my guess with her vehicle over the phone from an email.
It's good. It's a good start, and it's a cheap fix. So, Pamela, she could get some penetrating oil and give it a shot. All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Springfield. Steven's turn. Steven, you're on.
Hello. All right. Get ready to peel Ray off the ceiling. Here's another one. I got my third Honda Odyssey since 2005. I had a 2010, and now I got a 2015 with only 100,000 miles on it. And the question's about the slider doors. So the first two had auto sliders, totally screwed up. You know, we made it work. And then, you know, I thought I was really smart. I bought my 2015. I said, get me the manual one. And within 50,000 miles, it slowly became hard to open. And now it opens. You can get it open about 18 inches. And then you got to be Hulk Hogan to nudge it back about 6 inches at a time. You know, if you park it facing north and burn some sage, it'll get open. But it's ridiculous. So So then, you know, I brought it to the dealer. They looked at it. They did some other work. It was about $500 to take it apart to see what the problem was. And then they put it back together, and they told me it was going to be about $400 to $4,500 to fix.
Of course,
I'm getting the phone call saying, do you want to renew your long-term service contract? And they won't. Number one, I don't. Number two, I have to fix this in order to pay $3,000 or $4,000 to get the service contract separate.
Ouch.
But do you hear much of this stuff with whether manual or automatic specific to Honda Odysseys? I absolutely love them, but the experience with the dealer and everything, it's got me looking elsewhere. But what do you think?
Yeah, you know, those Odyssey doors, the sliding doors, were trouble for many, many years. And even the first generation Odysseys didn't have sliding doors. But after that, they became trouble. And the auto doors were horrendous. But if you stayed on top of it when the vehicle was younger, keeping all the moving parts sprayed up with like a WD-40 or something lightened, something that takes the moisture out of everything, you could keep them serviced and operating. There's wheels and rollers in there, and there's tracks and channels and all that stuff that gets killed by the salt and all the junk on the road that sprays up primarily in the wintertime around here. The rollers and stuff can be replaced. We had done them years ago. It's quite a bit of work to do them. But it may be too late now. Have you sprayed all the moving parts yourself to see if that helps?
I'm kind of a mechanical idiot. I grab some WD-40 once in a while when I'd open it and spray it wherever I could. I'm probably not hitting what I'm supposed to. And it also,
well, what you could do, because this is totally harmless, WD-40 makes this can with a smart straw. It's like a flexible straw, and you can bend that thing around and get into all kinds of different locations with it. And get a flashlight and open up the sliding doors if you can be inside, not in, you know, super cold, windy weather. But anything that moves, soak it with WD-40. It's not going to harm the paint or anything. You can, you know, you can dribble it all over. And, you know, clean anything, any of those tracks and rails that move, and maybe you can free it up on your own. Because if they're not auto doors, you don't have to worry about the cables and tracks and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
It's about all you can do other than then biting the bullet and, replacing those wheels and rollers and stuff.
So sorry, Stephen. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Altamont, New York. It's Kathleen. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello.
You're on.
Hi. My question is about mice getting into cars.
Oh, boy.
We have three automobiles. One is a Prius, a 2005 Prius. That was the one that we noticed it in first. That was the one where we had work done to try to abate entry. We also have a 2015 Subaru Forester and a 2014 Jeep Patriot. All three cars have mice.
Yep.
They enter in different places. I believe in the Subaru, they come in through the rear air flaps. They're one way. They can get in. The mice can get in those flaps. They're by the back fenders. But they can't get out because the flaps close. So I find mice traces in the wheel well. In the Prius, they came in probably the same way, but we abated with mesh, and the dealer put a lot of mesh covers in the front and the back and the engine. They seem to still be getting in the glove box. The dealer did say that the glove box had, they had chewed some holes that they could not abate entry access for. So that's probably the Achilles heel in the Prius after we've spent a lot of money and professional help.
Yikes. This is a common refrain, Kathleen. All right,
Gordon. We get this question every show.
Yeah.
Worse in, obviously, cold weather or fall particularly. I we've been through this so many times. There's nothing more I can tell you than what you've attempted to do. I've heard people with the ultrasonic devices that they'll put in the car with an extension cord. I don't know. I've tried them. I don't know if they work or not. mothballs smell horrible.
They don't work in the garden, and they don't. They don't work in the garden, and they don't work in the house.
No, no. All of that stuff doesn't seem to really matter. I've had mice make a nest near your mothballs. trapping, poison, but we had some
pushback on that. Yeah,
we had some pushback. That's a good term, Ray, on using mouse poison or rat poison around the vehicle. Of course, you got to be super careful where you put it with pets and all that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I have a lot of customers that trap the insides of their cars. They put mouse traps inside the car and catch them and throw them out.
I've done that, and I invariably get a few. I will not use the sticky ones. They're not humane. The other thing that I want to share is kind of funny. The soap, the very strong soap, I can't remember the name of that now, that they tell
Irish
you
Irish Spring?
Used to. Yes.
The double deodorant soap.
So I took an old butter. I took a, supposed to be the panacea, according to the mechanics. I took an old butter plastic tray, and I cut some holes in the cover and put a bar of Irish Spring in it, and then I put that in the glove box. Closed it up.
Did it work?
Yep.
And I thought, just the other day, I looked, there are mouse droppings inside the little butter container. The soap is being chewed.
Oh, my God. Well, at least you have very good-smelling mice. I mean, that's a plus.
So much for the Irish Spring. I was ready for that.
I'm having a lot of indigestion.
Well,
indigestion.
It's possible the little mice were speaking and saying bad words, and the mommy mice said, you're going to wash your mouth out with soap. Kathleen, this is a really tough problem, and it's real. If you keep your car outside, and I share your pain, it's a real problem, and not much we can do about this. So we're going to leave it there, and thank you for the call. Very quickly, maybe this is the same sort of a story. Let's go to Christine in Albany. Christine, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 2005 Jeep Liberty, and only occasionally when I have the heat on and I'm driving, I get a very noxious smell. If I turn the heat off for a couple minutes when it's cold, I can turn it back on without the smell. But the smell is very strong, like melted plastic.
No.
Mm. Do you are you hearing any abnormal noises when the blower motor is operating? Does it sound noisier or louder than it used to?
No, the heat is working fine. I'm not super impressed with the heat, but it's always been consistently okay. So there's no change except for this terrible smell.
So your vehicle is old enough to where it has what's called a blower motor resistor. And that resistor is in the airstream of the heating system. And they put it in the airstream to keep it cool because the little elements in there get hot and they control your lower speeds of your blower. And debris can get on that blower motor resistor, debris that gets past the grates under your hood. And if your car has a cabin filter, I don't know if it does. It's an 05, did you say?
Correct.
Yeah, that some cars had them, then some didn't. But we find so many absolutely disgusting cabin air filters because it's a highly overlooked component. And they get filled with all kinds of debris and junk and mouse droppings and everything you can imagine. And the mice will eat through those, and now you're getting debris and trash and junk getting sucked through there, and it all can go into your fan housing. It can go into your blower motor. And if pieces of it get on the resistor, it can melt them down if plastic got in there. I had a vehicle, it was a Ford Explorer, an early one, and the customer said, I'm getting little fiery pieces of tissue paper coming out my vents. I think it's going to be catching on fire. And I said, that's impossible. I took the blower motor resistor out, and mice had shredded a napkin or a tissue, and the tissue paper was all over the blower motor resistor, and some of them were burned. So anyway, that's where I would be looking. And you're going to have a shop do that, obviously, but that's what I would be checking.
All right, Christine, we have to leave it there. The show is just about over. Remind me next month, Gordon. James wrote in with a request to do a little tutorial on driving in a snowstorm, what a person should do if you feel the back of your car is fishtailing, goes in another direction. Let's pick that up first time you're on next month, which should be what? I know we have the date, but it's a Tuesday in February, right?
Well, in the meantime, I'll practice on slippery roads and get ready for it.
What they used to tell us back in the day was steer into the turn, which seems...
It's a lot of fun doing that.
It's a little counterintuitive, though. But anyway, hey, man, got to let you go. We'll talk to you next month.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Support comes from the Holiday Cottage Gift Shop, located in the historic Hotel Putnam Building, Main Street, Bennington, Vermont, featuring seasonal home decor. 802-430-3272 for store hours. At Glen Eddy Senior Living on the terrace at Glen Eddy Assisted Living off Consul Road in Niskayuna, a community of seniors who share similar interests and passions, part of Eddy Senior Living, Eddy, E-D-D-Y, seniorliving.com. Once again, thanks to Gordon Fricke for being here. Thanks for all the calls. So sorry, there were so many we left on the line. We'll get them next month, folks. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Andrea Leon screened the calls. Thanks, Andrea. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a bonus. It stems from last fall's lockbox. The gang will be here for a special midwinter edition of The Gardening Show. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.